Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order and issue a warm welcome to Co-Chair Berger and Co-Chair Barnhart and the other members of the House Revenue Committee as we prepare to listen to the latest forecast. So please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having us. I'm Mark McMullen with the Office of Economic Analysis, joined by Josh Lehner today from our office, as well as Joseph Portwright from Impresa Consulting, who is the chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. Josh and I will be giving the play-by-play today, and Joe will cut in with some color commentary and hopefully catch some of the tomatoes for us as well. In general, the revenue and economic environment has really stabilized some since the last time we met three months ago. Although the pace of job creation is still glacial, we've seen really broad-based improvement across a wide range of industries and occupations, and even the worst-off industries now, the bleeding has really stopped, and the job losses at least have stopped, if no hiring has happened. Now, while the recovery is appearing to be a bit more self-sustaining, there is still very much subject to external risks. These risks of Europe and federal fiscal policy have not gone away, and the risk and the probability of going back into recession is still uncomfortably high. So the need for contingency planning has not yet gone away. But that said, virtually all of the economic indicators we look at now are pointing up. They might not be suggesting strong growth. In fact, very few of them are suggesting strong growth, but most all of them are pointing to some sort of positive growth. In terms of the revenue situation, it's stabilized as well, but unfortunately the outlook is down somewhat yet again. We took a nasty hit when the last of the 2010 extended personal income tax returns were processed this fall. Folks overpaid by a surprising amount in April, and that came back to haunt us. But luckily, 2010 is now pretty much in the books, so it can't do much more harm to us going forward. And looking at more forward-looking sort of revenues, all of the stuff that is tied to contemporaneous economic activity, these are actually tracking better than we expected. In particular, the withholdings out of wages and salaries we expected to fall off at the beginning of the year and to date have not. So to start with the economic outlook, we again will follow the same sort of pattern where we look at the broad U.S. trends and then boil down to Oregon and then talk about what that means and implies for our revenue picture. Since the last time we talked, the employment outlook across the country has improved. This chart is from the Philadelphia Fed. It shows contemporaneous labor market conditions. The left side, we have September, and the right side, we have December. Green here suggests that the state is expanding its labor market, and red would be contracting. In September, Oregon was in the contracting category due almost entirely to a big month of government job cuts. But now, everyone is out, and besides a couple of places in the Rust Belt, pretty much every state is improving, and in particular, in January, we're going to see even more improvement because we had a very encouraging job number, but it was at the U.S. level this month, but it was just 1 month, and maybe Joe wants to weigh in a little bit on what we should make of that happy number.
Yeah, I think when you compare these two charts, you see that there was some skittishness about the prospects for economic growth in the fall. Those were not encouraging numbers, either at the state level or the national level. The national non-farm payroll number in October was a pretty weak 100,000. And what we're seeing now is some encouraging signs that suggest that we don't need to worry quite so much about a decline in the growth rate, that the recovery seems to be continuing to proceed as we had forecast. So the way I would look at this is that, we had some reasons for pessimism in the fall, and I think now we don't need to be as pessimistic as we were then.
Among all the tea leaves we look at in terms of trying to predict the direction of near-term job creation or employment, the best one, in my opinion, by far, are jobless claims or the initial claims for unemployment insurance, people showing up for their unemployment check for the first time. And this is extremely encouraging in recent months as we have come down from the record highs we saw during the recession. Now, both in the U.S. and the nation as a whole, these unemployment claims are down to a level that's consistent or roughly consistent with past expansions. Now, while we're back to a normal level for Oregon is quite a bit higher than that for the U.S. because of the nature of its job market.
Yeah, we clearly have a different structure of our economy. In Oregon, we're more dependent on durable goods manufacturing, which tends to have a higher volatility. We have more seasonal industries, things like agriculture, than is true of the U.S. economy. And we have this sort of continual background of in-migration, which also serves to push up our unemployment rate above what you find in other places. But these numbers are encouraging in the sense that they're way down from the peaks that we observed when the economy was in real trouble 2.5-3 years ago. But as you notice, if you look at the chart, when we're really in a growth phase, we want to, the new claims numbers fall below that dotted line. That means that we're reducing the unemployment rate. Obviously, with an 8.9% unemployment rate, we have a long way to go to get back to a normal level of unemployment.
Now, in terms of the outlook, our outlook for employment growth has been virtually unchanged over the past 6 months. Now, that's not true of Global Insights forecast, which is our vendor we use for the U.S. outlook. Here you see how their forecast has evolved over time, the highest being in April of 2011, which is what we based the closed session forecast on, which then dropped to the lowest point this fall in October of 2011, which was somewhere in between a recession and a recovery at that time. And since now they are back up to where they were 6 months ago, which is sort of where we stood pat the whole time, our thinking was that this red line, the October outlook, was not a reasonable outlook insofar as if we were going to go south, if the economy was going to turn south, things would be a lot worse than this. And so we chose to stick with the baseline at that time, but there was much discussion among our advisory groups, and not everyone was on the same page.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you notice when you look here is that that our vendor, our national forecast vendor, Global Insight, decided to get a lot more pessimistic in the fall based on some of that information that we just looked at. And the view of the council at that time was not to be so pessimistic as that. And so we used a number for the national economy that was not as pessimistic. And I think that judgment seems to have been borne out by the evidence that we've seen in the last few months. So, there's sometimes a certain ADHD quality to economic forecasting that folks feel compelled to incorporate this month's number in their forecast and let it drive them. And I think one of the things that the council tries to do is suggest that we want to look at a broader range of evidence and not be causing the forecast number to fluctuate based on the very latest information.
That's right, and we're talking about a big fluctuation here, as you see, from that purple April line to the blue line. Now we've reduced general fund revenues by on the order of $300 million. You see about the same distance between the blue line and that red. So what's pushing our outlook for job growth? Primarily, it's that businesses are profitable and they're flush with cash. And in economics, this means that they will expand. or there at least there is an incentive to expand. This chart here maps profits against job growth, job growth being blue and profits being red. But the profits are a year ahead of jobs in this picture. We see job growth a year from now will reflect profits today. If so, that's good news, because profits are still up at a record level. And this would suggest that there is some positive momentum for the job market. But this momentum might not be that large. As you see, the last time we had a profit boom, although the timing was right, this increase in the blue line, this increase in employment, only reached roughly 2% rate at its max, which is not a whole lot of jobs compared to what Oregon is used to in a recovery. So going forward, will we get to see something more like a normal or rather a historical average job growth this time, given that we do have quite a bit of profitability? And there is, again, there's a little bit of difference of opinion on the council. We have a couple of our members who actually do planning forecasts, Connerly Consulting and PGE model, that both suggest quite a bit stronger job growth this time than this 2%, or a little bit stronger, around the 2.4% range. This time we're not quite so bullish. The OEA model, we're looking at more on the order of 1.5% employment growth.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair point to make, is that on the council you do have a diversity of both backgrounds, and anytime you get a group of economists together, opinions. So there is a range of possibilities out there. There is some upside potential if we see the gains, particularly in capital goods industries and exports. But there's some reasons to believe that this kind of recovery that we're in the aftermath of a financial crisis and the continuing challenges in the housing market mean that we'll see some slower growth than we've seen in past recoveries, notwithstanding this level of overall business profitability.
And while these profits haven't caused a big wave of hiring among businesses, they are investing, and that is some sort of expansion. And this fits our story, our narrative we've had here for the past couple of years, that this expansion is going to be led by business investment, production of goods, export and trade, rather than consumer industries that are still reeling after the financial crisis. As you see here, a business investment equipment demand is back up to pre-recession levels. We're seeing this across a range of equipment, in particular technology goods. The replacement cycle, businesses couldn't wait in order to replace their technology goods, otherwise they'd fall behind too far in productivity. So this is good. At least we're getting income, if not jobs. And the story with trade is holding up for now as well. We're still seeing, aside if we exclude our technology producers, where we have real big valuable exports that are noisy and subject to trade within industries, as one firm trades with itself, ships things overseas to its factories. This inflates our import and export numbers. But aside from that, all of our other exports, the bulk stuff that really matters for the economy, the stuff that uses longshoremen and transportation and warehousing, this is still growing, albeit at a slower rate than it was about a year ago. We're still seeing healthy improvement in trade. Now, this is a threat. And I brought this up a little bit with the council, the issue being obviously our external threats have to do with weakness globally, both in China and in Europe. Right now, we're not incorporating that in terms of a real slowdown in trade in our baseline outlook, but it is certainly a downside risk.
Yeah, I think a couple things to pay attention to here. One, we're in a little better position than the U.S. economy because we are more dependent on durable goods manufacturing, things that are sold to businesses for those capital investment plans that Mark was talking about. So things like high technology products, transportation, metals, machinery, and the like. So we benefit from that a bit because consumers are still relatively weak, and we're more trade dependent. But then there are some risks in both of those because those two sets of activities are sensitive to the kind of disruptions that we could potentially get in Europe. And I think that's the key thing to be aware of here is our forecast is assuming basically that the Europeans muddle through and that there isn't a big global slowdown or a financial crisis. But if there is, and there's certainly that possibility, then we would expect to see a much slower growth in Oregon.
So turning to the dark side here, away from our drivers of the recovery, what's keeping it slow? And this fits the narrative that we've been telling for a couple years as well. In particular, a lot of it has to do with consumer industries and the nature of the recovery following a financial crisis. In part, American consumers have to repair their savings, have to fix their balance sheets. And this isn't going to happen overnight, but we know there's still work to do. And so what this means is as consumers save a higher share of their income, we get less fuel for economic growth. What you see here is kind of the opposite of the savings rate. This is a spending rate, looking at the amount that consumers spend as a share of their after-tax income that they take in. And right now, after we've seen some increase in recent months with this release of pent-up demand, we've seen a lot of durable goods sales from consumers, big increases in home furnishings, autos, and the like, big ticket items. They're not back up to pre-recession levels by any measure. We were doing 16, 17 million units of auto sales before the recession. Now we're back up into the 15 range, but there's certainly a lot of improvement. And it's not because consumers have more money or households have more money. It's because they've waited so long and at some point they have to spend. But looking at this rate, we're closer to the 98-99% of income being spent that we were seeing in the peak of the housing boom when consumers were using their homes like an ATM and pulling out mortgage equity withdrawal and basically spending every dime they brought in, than we were back in the 60s and 70s. Now, there are reasons it was lower in the 60s and 70s. We had double-digit inflation rate, so savings looked to be a better idea, and also we had less of a social safety net, particularly in the 60s, so that folks had to save more for their private retirement. But going forward, like I say, we're a lot closer to the housing boom than we are to the 70s and 60s, so there will be headwinds on spending over the extended horizon. Where we really see, obviously, the epicenter of this downturn was the housing market and construction. And construction is particularly important for Oregon, not just for its local economy, but also because the wood product firms service the nationwide construction activity. And the good news here is that the bleeding has stopped. This shows spending on residential, non-residential, and public construction. And now the bleeding actually started in the public construction, you see, after the federal money started to go away. But nevertheless, in terms of private payrolls, at least they've stabilized. And we're actually starting to hear analysts a little bit more bullish on housing, finally. Now, we're not so sure, when this turnaround is going to come. I mean, there is some light at the end of the tunnel. We know that the construction activity and spending are going to turn around before house prices do because we have all this overhang of excess supply. But the question is when? And are we going to get some push from these traditional industries like construction that tend to lead recoveries, not hold them back? This is certainly a place where there is a lot of diversity of opinion on the council in terms of construction, and I believe Joe is one of the more pessimistic members, so maybe he can bring you down a little.
Yeah, sorry about that. I think there are good reasons to be very pessimistic about any kind of rapid recovery in housing. I think we'll see a little bit of improvement, particularly in multifamily, in the apartment sector for rental housing. But there's still some really serious structural problems in the single-family home ownership market. Collectively, homeowners in the United States saw about half of their owner's equity go away when housing bubbles collapsed. We went from about $13 trillion worth of home equity in the U.S. to about $7 trillion, and that weighs on consumer spending. There's still about 20% of the people with mortgages in the United States are underwater on their mortgage. That is, they owe more on their home mortgage than their home is worth. We still have very high unemployment rates, 8.9% in the state, 8.3% nationally. You usually don't see a big turnaround in the housing market until unemployment rates start coming down and incomes start going up. We don't see a lot of evidence of that. And I think the most important thing to think about is, you know, the psychology of the housing consumer has changed pretty dramatically. 4 or 5 years ago, everybody thought housing was a great deal, and the more money you could put into it, the more money you would end up making, and that housing prices would already go up. I think most people are disabused of that notion now. I'd hope so, anyhow. And what that means is what we were doing a few years ago was everybody was just betting on housing and making money on it. And now there are a lot fewer incentives for people to go out and buy housing. And that coupled with, you know, again, we have the lowest housing prices. They're lowest relative to the peak, and they haven't started going up. So until housing prices start going up, it's really unlikely that we'll see a big rebound in housing. Sorry to rain on the housing parade there, Mark, but we don't think, as in past recoveries, the housing sector sort of pulled the economy along and helped things accelerate. That doesn't really look like that's in the cards, certainly at least for the next couple of years and probably longer.
Thank you. Yes, and I think that's absolutely right, and a lot of it has to do the way Joe characterized it. The day that households expect their house to be worth more next year than it is today, we may finally actually get some traction in the industry. Broadly, consumer sentiment out there is better, not in the housing market, but it is better, and that's one of the things that makes us optimistic overall. In fact, one statistic I like is that the number of households that expect their income to go up next year is finally greater than the number of households that expect it to go down, and this is only in the last couple of months, for the first time since the recession, this is true, and I think that really speaks well for the outlook. But the outlook is still under a lot of risk. Our vendor says that the probability of recession has fallen significantly since we last met a couple of months ago. But I'm not so sure things have changed. And Josh is going to go a little bit into detail about some of the major risks we're facing.
Broadly speaking, we like to think of the potential risk out there in two main categories. One is international risk, and two are domestic risk. And at this point in time, a lot of them have to do with some policy decisions that need to be made across the Atlantic and the European financial system, the European Union, and then domestically here in Washington, D.C., what are we going to do with tax policy? Extension of unemployment benefits and the payroll tax cut and things like that. What would those do to the domestic economy? And what you see in front of you is basically a chart that you saw last time, just updated with some new numbers as well, of how risky some of the interest rate spreads are on these other European 10-year bonds relative to the U.S. You can see for the bulk of the numbers, they're relatively unchanged. They've improved a little bit for some of the larger economies in Europe and gotten worse for Portugal and Greece, which are rated substantially worse than junk at this point in terms of their market rates. The baseline case, as Joe made earlier, is that Europe muddles through. The European Central Bank has taken a lot of new different types of collateral and extended loans to a lot of these institutions to help muddle through this process. But there is certainly a dark scenario that exists. And I don't know if Joe wants to talk about that some more.
Yeah, I think the way to think about Europe is, again, our base case is Europeans sort of figure out their problems and don't have a serious recession. There are two possibilities. One is sort of Europe catches cold. What the Europeans are doing right now is cutting budgets left and right. There's a lot of austerity in Europe. We're seeing a slowdown in growth. Europe is probably headed for recession. The UK is already in a recession as a result of those fiscal policies and trying to cope with their fiscal problems. That's that's sort of the least bad of the two alternatives. The real problem is that rather than catching cold, the Europeans have a seizure, a financial seizure like we had in 2007, where financial markets react very badly to, say, a potential sovereign default, and Greece and Portugal are the two risky cases. Now, what's happened so far is the European community has managed to cobble together some funding packages and expand the financial capability of the European Central Bank to stave off, to postpone the potential of financial crisis. But that doesn't mean that's resolved yet. And in some respects, we're in a similar situation with the European financial markets that we were in with the housing market in the U.S. in the early part of 2007. People could see that it was starting to, prices were starting to decline, that there was some debt out there, but nobody really knew how that situation would get resolved. Now, we're optimistic. We hope that it gets wound up successfully, but there's always a risk of financial market contagion. And in just the same way that Greek bankers probably weren't very concerned about American mortgages in 2007, we would be probably a bit surprised to realize that we may have some stake in what happens with the Greeks and their sovereign debt in the next few years, because it could affect us.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Just very briefly, the relative size of Portugal and Greece is tiny, isn't it, compared to these other numbers you have up there?
If you were talking about the debt, the sovereign debt, the outstanding in all, yes, of those categories, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about very, very small numbers. They're a lot smaller than California, for example, aren't they?
I think if you added them together, they would be a lot smaller. I think the question is one of contagion. Does that then spill over into other areas? And if you look in the next category there, you've got Ireland, Italy, and Spain. Italy and Spain in particular are much, much larger.
Sorry.
And much larger than, I think if you add them together, than California. Again, our baseline forecast is not that this implodes. We expect that they can take care of it. But I think the challenge is nobody really knows with the complex leveraging of collateralized debt obligations, some of the same kinds of financial derivatives that you saw in the housing market. Nobody really knows how, if one piece of this system goes down, how it reverberates through other parts of the financial system. And even if you're ultimately able to work it out, there's still the possibility that you have this financial dislocation where financial markets seize up for a period of time. And that's what could trigger something similar to, although hopefully not as serious as what we experienced in September 2008.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
And then quickly on the domestic risk, again, it goes back to what is federal policy going to be set for a lot of the taxes that are expiring or are set to expire in the near term, and what sort of political bargains can be made. And what you see in front of you is federal grants and aid to states. You can see that it increased $150 billion or so during the earlier part of the recession. It's come down about $100 billion since then. They're talking about some different sequesters at the federal level for this category, and it's on the magnitude of maybe about $12 billion overall. So if you do a 1 percentage point of that for Oregon's share or thereabouts, it's about $120 million. So far, they're not talking about Medicaid, but if that starts to get thrown around in terms of some of these sequesters at the federal level, then that would be a whole lot more money than what we're talking about so far. So this is a potential risk for the total all funds budget here in Oregon.
Yeah, I think the takeaway there is that what they're talking about now in Washington, though, is nothing like the pain that you all have suffered through in the last year or so as these federal funds have gone away.
Quick update on some of the recent Oregon facts. 8.9% unemployment rate in December. The corresponding U.S. rate in December was 8.5. It has now dropped to 8.3 in January. Oregon rate is down 2.7 percentage points in the last couple of years. Job growth is 20th fastest among all states at 1.18% in November. We were in top 7, top 10 rankings 6-8 months ago. We've now had a number of flat labor market reports, and that's dropped our ranking somewhat, but we still are in the top half of all states. Non-farm employment has increased 35,000 since the bottom in December 2009 here in Oregon. The private sector is up nearly 40,000. You do the math on that, that means the public sector is down 4,700. The bulk of that is in the local government category. Personal income growth is 4.5% on a year-over-year basis. You will see that from the second quarter to the third quarter last year, actually income declined. That is due to transfer payments declining, so unemployment benefits expiring for individuals that have exhausted their benefits. If you look at all the other underlying income components, they are flat to up slightly. Wages, proprietor's income, you have some dividends, interest, and rent, things like that continue to grow both on a year-over-year and a quarter-over-quarter basis. One of the sectors that did quite well in 2010 was exports. They had increased over almost 19% in 2010, which is a really robust year here in Oregon. They've leveled off more so in November in total, but it has to do with some different industry components. The high-tech sector has had some declines in exports, but it has to do with some very specific projects that are going on here in Oregon and abroad. But the other sectors outside of high-tech are growing at close to 20-30% on a year-over-year basis. Agriculture products, transportation equipment. We're exporting some mining equipment up to Canada. Things like that are doing very, very well here in Oregon. So this 3.8% through November is a little bit misleading. You have to look at some of the sub-industry components of that. So this graph shows Oregon's employment jobs over the last 2 years relative to the U.S. The U.S. is red, Oregon is blue. You can see that in early 2011, Oregon saw some very strong employment gains, and we were significantly outpacing the average state in the nation overall in terms of job growth, and then it's been essentially relatively flat since then. We've lost some momentum in the last 9 months in the employment reports, while the U.S. has continued to grow steadily. So over the last 2 years, we've grown about the same rate as the U.S., unfortunately, I have some bad news to bring to you. The benchmark process, every year they revise the employment numbers going back over the previous year or so, and this blue line will actually be shifted down slightly in the coming weeks. I believe February 28th is when the Employment Department will release the revised Oregon numbers. You might hear a big scary number of 5,000 or 7,000, something like that, down. It's actually not that much in terms of the overall picture. It's just that the current estimates are slightly above what the underlying job growth has actually been. We continue to improve over the last couple of years, just maybe not quite as fast as we think we are right now. This is the fits and starts. We saw the strong growth in late 2010 and in early 2011, and then essentially flat since then. The horizontal bar is the average monthly gain during an expansion in Oregon for the private sector. I know that's a lot of words, but we normally get about 3,000 private sector jobs a month, and lately we've been well below that threshold.
Thanks. Now, while the employment numbers that Josh has been talking about have been somewhat lackluster in Oregon and disappointing, those come from the payroll survey, a survey of establishments where you go around to businesses and ask them how many people they have on their payrolls. But all of our other economic or labor market indicators seem to be much healthier than the payroll survey. In particular, the survey of households. Instead of going around and asking businesses, they go around and knock on doors and ask households, do you have a job or don't you have a job? And some economists would argue that this household survey is more accurate around turning points of the economy. And we've seen a lot more improvement in the household survey, and we hear about this in terms of Oregon's improvement in the unemployment rate. But there's a lot of misinformation out there with the improvement in the unemployment rate, because the unemployment rate can be high for good reasons or it can be low for bad reasons. And so it makes it kind of confusing to interpret. But I think unequivocally this improvement in the unemployment rate is a really, really good indicator and is a good thing, even though there are a lot of caveats in the media. What we see here are the factors that have brought us from our high of 11.6% unemployment rate in June of 2009 down to where we are right now, 8.9% as of December 2011. And as you see, the vast majority of this improvement can be accounted for by what we want, the good things, the green arrows. The number of employed workers in the household survey has increased by 60,000 workers, as Josh has told you, it was only 35,000 or something at the establishment survey. And at the same time, the number of unemployed workers has dropped. by 53,000 workers. Now, part of that is, you know, as you lose workers, you know, it's not always good. Some folks give up looking for work, and that's the red arrow. As technically, this is called marginally attached workers by the Employment Department. They don't like my giving up my loose labels, but at any rate, the idea being that a lot of folks have said our improvement in the unemployment rate is just due to people giving up, becoming discouraged and leaving the labor force, and therefore the unemployment rate drops even though things are worse. And that's certainly a case. We've seen here 16,000 people gave up looking over this period. That is an increase over the period from before, and it certainly is not a good sign for the labor market. But at the same time, the overall labor force has increased and is still going, which, although that's a good thing, puts upward pressure on this measure of the employment rate. But the takeaway here is that the vast majority of this change has to do with the green arrows, the good things, rather than the red arrows, the bad things, as people leave and give up looking. But everything isn't hunky-dory. This labor force participation story, there is going to be, you know, there are issues with that going forward in terms of, you know, how bullish we can be about the labor market recovery.
Yeah. And there are these two things going on. One is a very short-term thing in response to the conditions in the labor market. As Mark said, some people will give up looking for work, and that gives us this sort of false positive signal that things are getting better, but that doesn't seem to be the big driver of what's happening. Longer term, though, we know that there are some demographic changes occurring. The workforce is aging. There are fewer people in the prime working age years, and that means that the labor force will grow less rapidly in the future, which will mean economic growth will be somewhat slower than it would otherwise be.
So turning to some of our leading indicators for the Oregon economy, this is one I want to just briefly mention because it's so positive. This is the average work week among Oregon's manufacturing workers. And you see here in the last few weeks, this has increased sharply and is now as high as it was during the last expansion when we were adding manufacturing jobs, the last time we were adding manufacturing jobs. The idea here is that it's a decent leading indicator because firms are going to stretch their existing workforce is very thin before taking on the risk of a new full-time employee. So this certainly speaks well to the manufacturing output. Again, our story here is that we need our producers of goods and our investment-type demand to keep things going until the consumer can get back on their feet. And manufacturing has already expanded for 2 years running. So, you know, there's a concern that the cycle is over. This would suggest that we still have some juice left.
Turning now to some of the different indexes we have here on Oregon data, there's four in front of you. The top green line is the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Coincident Index. If you remember those maps you saw on the very first slide, this is Oregon's version of that. And you can see that it declined and stalled out during the summer months. Oregon was red or pink on that first map, and it's turned strongly positive in recent months due to the increase in manufacturing hours and some better declines in the unemployment rate. The bottom two lines are the two leading indexes we have here in Oregon. The blue line is our offices, OILY, and the red line is the University of Oregon's Index of Economic Indicators. You can see they generally follow the same pattern over time, although our index has turned strongly positive in recent months due to some strong gains we've seen in air freight shipments out of the Portland International Airport. It's a good measure of business activity. Industrial production continues to go up. The initial unemployment claims continue to decline. So overall, our index has turned strongly positive, whereas the other leading index is showing, you know, relatively stable in recent months. I think overall this bodes well for future employment growth in Oregon. Hopefully, we'll start seeing more positive numbers, whereas we saw some negatives and some positives in the most recent 6-9 months.
So turning to how we've changed the outlook, here's the Oregon employment outlook that we typically show you in terms of expressing this as how far we go down in the recession and when we get back up to the number of jobs we had before the recession began. The dotted green line was the December baseline. The dotted red line, slightly worse, is the current March baseline. There's not much to this story. As you saw, since we spoke last, we had two more dead months of employment in terms of no job gains here in Oregon. So this has kicked out our return to peak by about 2 months, our return to our previous level of employment. You see the slope or the rate of job gains has really not changed significantly. But the takeaway here is not a positive one. 80 months out, we're looking at roughly a full 7 years of recession. This brings us back at the very end of 2014. But even so, it's a long time, but it's at least a faster, at the same rate as the U.S., even though Oregon took a much harder hit. Here in this chart, the U.S. is red, and as you see, at the worst, the U.S. lost 6% of their jobs at the worst of the recession, where Oregon was more like 8.5% of their jobs. But our expectation is for the traditional advantages that Oregon sees in the upswing to kick back in, and that at the end of the day, we'll get back to peak about the same time as other states, even though we underwent a much more pronounced swing. Why? You know, why does Oregon have this extra business cycle of volatility? Two main reasons. One is manufacturing. We're still a manufacturing state, particularly our metropolitan areas. Even though manufacturing is a reduced role in the overall economy, relative to other areas, we're still certainly a place that makes goods. And we've already talked about the fact that that does look like an advantage in this particular recovery. The second reason we have an advantage usually in expansions is our population growth, that we draw workers from other states as soon as job opportunities are relatively available. This one's a little more problematic going forward. While the pattern of population growth appears the same, the new census data would suggest that Oregon is still relatively a good destination relative to other states. The level of these migration flows has slowed drastically since the recession began. Domestic migrants usually move with a job in hand, and without job opportunities, that's of course slowed this down, and also the housing crisis. A lot of folks are trapped in either bad mortgages or unsellable houses and are unwilling to move because of that. And so this is a question mark, whether or not Oregon will enjoy its traditional population gain advantages going forward over other states.
Yeah, and I think that is something that Mark's absolutely right about. The housing crisis in particular has cut down on the amount of migration nationally. However, Oregon continues to be a destination, and people come here, as we know, even without jobs. That's part of the reason our unemployment rate is consistently higher than other places. The other thing that's going on is, again, this demographic shift. As Americans are getting older, the older you are, the less likely you are to move across state lines, and that's reducing the amount of inflow of population. But migration is still a net positive for Oregon, which is part of the reason we expect those lines to converge over the next few years.
So to finish up in the econ, and then we'll hit the revenue. Here is the picture of our forecasts for employment growth in Oregon that we've given for the past 2 years. The light blue line, the most optimistic, as you see, was given back in the close of session May forecast. Since then, we've seen a flat 3/4 of employment growth, and that has moved this line out to where we are now at the red line. So a flat 3/4 of employment growth, you can interpret that as $350 million less than expected revenue.
Okay. Before we move to the next section, Senator Morris has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Slide 25, I'm curious if anything has changed from your reporting. It's been maybe a couple of years ago with respect to the in-migration, out-migration patterns showing that high-income earners are leaving the state and low-income earners are coming into the state. Is there any data that shows that is changing one way or the other?
Go ahead.
In the process of, we follow this through, of course, the revenue picture is very important. You know, the high-income folks move the needle a lot, and there's been a lot of discussion with the tax rates on the higher-income folks that were put in the 09 session. What we're seeing in the raw number, if you just look at the numbers of millionaires in Oregon, you know, that are coming in and leaving in terms of these tax returns that just appear, one year you file an Oregon return and the next year you don't, or the other way around, where one year you're not filing a return and then all of a sudden you're in Oregon and you're a millionaire. Oregon is still netting millionaires in the average year. They're still on average, we're still getting more millionaires than we're giving up in the average year in recent years. But that might be deceptive. When we talk to our revenue advisors, one of the things the accountants mention is that what they lose a lot of times in terms of tax advantages, you don't lose an entire return. Someone basically half moves to Washington because they can't, you know, they don't, for tax purposes. So what happens is, you know, you get your income cut in half, maybe you're no longer in the category, or even if you are. But that won't show up as losing a millionaire. You still have the millionaire, but we've lost half of their income.
Because they still work in Oregon to get income from Oregon, but they live elsewhere.
That's right. And even with the capital gains or whatnot, sometimes you can't pull up everything and take it with you. But you can half.
The question I had was, you talked about the world situation, and we now have a situation in Iran that would threaten to drastically cut off oil supplies, either because of being bombed by Israel or shutting the Strait of Hormuz, or both. Has Global Insight factored in that risk factor, and what impact would it have if we saw a very sharp increase in gas prices?
The sharp increase in oil prices is not built into the forecast at this time. There's been a lot of independent research that you can read online regarding the price elasticity and the shocks and that. Is it 7% or something like that of oil supplies go through that strait? And so if that were to be cut off, you would expect a significant rise in the oil price, and what kind of shock that would have on the real economy would be pretty dramatic. Although one of the interesting things that's come out of the recent research in oil price shocks is that consumers look back about 3 years. They look at oil prices and gas prices over about the last couple years, and that the fact that we've had high oil prices in recent years, high gas prices, the prices of the pump haven't gone down that much from where they were a couple years ago. Certainly they're up over 10 years. That would have less of an effect on consumers' budget just because they remember what $4 a gallon of gas looked like, even if it's down to $3.50 right now.
And Senator Burdick, while Josh makes a good point that we don't have it in our baseline outlook, it maybe I should note that Global Insight's baseline outlook for oil prices is definitely on the high side of the consensus. They've always been, and they keep us up around $100 barrel from now until, you know, the end of time. And so I think hopefully it won't make a big difference, but it is certainly one of the primary shocks out there, and is discussed in our revenue text.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As long as we're talking about factors going forward and looking back, I heard you mention that there is at least perhaps some good news on the horizon around the housing market, not particularly yet. How long has that been weighing down Oregon's economy in the forecast, and how much of the difficulty in predictability has been due to a slower than expected recovery of the housing market?
Representative Bailey, I think the housing market is one of the few things I think we've gotten right so far. Now, the jury's still out. The way Josh has put it is, now we're about a year from the end of the tunnel. We've always had the light at the same place. It's been the end of 2013, pretty much, or 2 years from the end of the tunnel, but it's been the end of 2013 in our model for quite some time, before even I arrived, I believe.
It's been there for at least a couple years.
So
So whether or not that unfolds is still an open question. But at least Global Insight, our vendor, has had in their outlook, oh, housing will turn around in a year or so, in a year or so, in a year or so. And so now our lights are probably about at the same place in terms of when we're going to pull out of this. But again, I just hope it happens before we lose wind from all of these cyclical goods industries that are helping us now.
Senator Hess.
Thank you. You earlier referenced the overpayments last April. Is there an explanation for that?
Thank you. We'll move on to seeing where we are in the revenue estimates address Senator Hass's question on our tracking slide. I have some comments I was planning to make. In terms of income tax collections, the big one, personal income tax collections, I always put this up just because I try to fight the perception that our taxes are falling. Our taxes are not falling. Our forecast is being lowered, but tax revenues are not falling. Here you see we ended the last biennium still at double-digit rates of personal income tax collections. The preliminary January numbers are much worse. And although not that important for the year, they are much worse and suggest that this strong growth we've seen is about to slow. For corporate income taxes, that's already happened. The most recent quarter, we're down some 16% year over year. And so far, again, the preliminary data that's not in this graph for January and February has not been good. In fact, we really pulled in no corporate income tax collections. Not that January and February are very big months or that important. Some Januaries on record, we've actually given back more than we've taken in. But it certainly doesn't signal good things ahead for corporate. So how we're tracking is, aside from this issue with the 2010 taxes, things are tracking fairly well along with forecast. We expected the last quarter of the 2011 calendar year, we expected personal income taxes to increase by some 12.5%, and they went up by 10%. So we missed by $35 million, and pretty much all of that can be traced to a larger-than-expected volume of refunds that came in October and November as the 2010 extension files were processed. Now, it's always the case that extended filers overpay. They don't want to pay penalties in April, so they overpay in April, typically on average, and then get some back, either through the refunds, which we see here, or through the other part where we took a hit, which is in January estimated payments. Either they get a refund back right away, or they say, oh, just apply it to my next payment. And we're seeing very, very weak estimated payments as well. And so the question is, well, why did they make particularly big overpayments this time? And I think a lot of it had to do with uncertainty. And it was not in 2010 and all the growth we saw in fiscal year 2011 when income taxes grew at a 12% rate, a lot of that has to do with all this volatile non-wage forms of income. These things that are particularly hard not just for us but for accountants and taxpayers to figure out how much they owe at the end of the year. So my guess is that they covered their bases by overpaying in April. Unfortunately, we thought more of that was real than was, and we've given it back. But once again, 2010 can't hurt us much anymore. It's past us, and 2012 is looking much better. In particular, these withholdings of wages and taxes out of wages and salaries are still growing at 5, 6, 7% rates. And we were terrified about this going into 2012. There are so many headwinds on revenues heading into 2012 that we have growth very slow relative to underlying growth in the economy, and certainly very slow relative to last year. You know, in fiscal year 2011, we had 12% general fund growth, but personal incomes, the underlying economy, grew by less than half of that. And so in Oregon, whenever we have these hypercyclical revenues or this kind of party, we know there's going to be a hangover where going forward at some point our income tax revenues are probably going to grow slower than the underlying economy. And our office believes that a lot of that slowdown should come immediately.
because of a lot of factors that are out there. A couple of policy factors. We had changes in withholding tables that are reversing themselves now. And we have some of the Measure 66 reverts coming up. And in terms of the economy, the big one is, of course, the stock market correction we saw this year that took a big step back. So, of course, that will hit this April, or we'll find out to what extent that is an issue this April. And then in the withholdings, we had a couple of other issues, other types of income that were holding up withholdings, which appear to be going away. One being transfer payments, in particular unemployment insurance payments. I guess not a silver lining, but a dark lining to the good news of lower unemployment, people on jobless claims and unemployment rolls, is that, well, all of this withholding we've been getting out of unemployment checks is going to go away. And then the second issue would be retirement income. And this is weighing on the longer-term forecast as well. Retirement income, another thing we learned when the 2010 taxes got settled, was that there was a tremendous amount of tapping of retirement wealth among the high-income and low-income households alike. They were getting into their IRAs in order to pay the rent. And so this would suggest, again, and these are taxable, and this would suggest, again, that we're going to see less growth in 2012. So we have quite a bit of a pullback going forward. Corporate, you see here just how fast it's falling. We predicted it would fall at a 15% rate. It fell at a 16% rate, so it's a little bit better than we expected, but the news is unequivocally bad. And so on that, we are down again, $35 million on the combined general fund and lottery fund for the current biennium. I guess in my tenure, that is 5 out of 6 downward revisions, putting us at $341 million, or 2% below where we were at the close of session.
2% below, oh, that must be a reverse kicker coming our way.
You guys will have to put that in statute.
Good luck on that.
So here's the decomposition across, and you see most of it is personal income taxes. We took this 2010 hit in personal income taxes, and then they get bad in the out years. A lot of this, again, has to do with the impact down the road of retirement sources of income getting worse. But this is the breakout. But where we're seeing tracking so far is pretty good. Like I say, other than this 2010, virtually every single, even little dinky line item we have from the agencies is tracking a little bit above forecast so far. All bets are off in an income tax state until we get an April in the door, but everything is tracking ahead. All that is except for the lottery. The lottery has been tracking below forecast ever since I got here.
Chair Barnhart.
Yeah, a couple of things on this set of things that you've just been talking about. If I understood you correctly, your projection is down, but actual income in all categories except the lottery is actually up from previous receipts.
Representative Barnhart, that is, again, when I to conveniently ignore this big hit we got from the 2010 taxes. And that, you know, that, of course, is a shock that is unequivocally negative. It's a one-time thing, so it doesn't bother us going forward. And when I talk about everything tracking above, I mean all sort of the stuff that's tied to the contemporaneous economic activity.
Let me try it again. There's a difference between your revenue estimate and a change in the revenue estimate and the actual production of tax revenue in the system. And you made the point yourself early in your presentation, I think, when and I believe what you said, and correct me if I've missed that, is that our revenues continue to increase on a regular basis. Your projection of how much they're going to increase was a little bit too high.
Yeah, thanks, Representative Barnard. I get it now. Yes, that's absolutely right. It's so far all of the reductions have really been in the rate of increase in overall revenues and not the amount. Right now, like I say, we saw we saw 12% revenue general fund growth in fiscal year 2011. We're expecting about half of that in each of 2012 and 2013. The revisions we're talking about now, you go from instead of 6% growth, you go to 5.8% growth, and that gives you your $35 million. But, yes, so all we're doing is making the outlook a little bit more pessimistic.
Right. And a different topic, if I'm slightly different topics. On the lottery, the actual revenue in lottery is down, is it not? Or have I misunderstood that?
It's flat or re-increasing at a snail's pace, 1% okay. a year, something like that. It was growing at leaps and bounds up until the recession and smoking ban hit, and it with the video lottery being the dominant source, that dropped significantly, and since then has been really on the bottom, crawling up ever so slowly. Eventually, we expect it to grow at about the same rate as other spending, but the lottery folks are getting more and more pessimistic each time we speak to them.
Okay, so your long-term expectations continued to be higher, but not at the rate that they were in the past.
That's right. That's right. Josh can speak to exactly where we are in terms of the growth rate, around 1%?
Right. Representative Barnhart, absolutely. Fiscal year 11, I think we saw nearly 2% growth in video lottery sales. So far in fiscal year 12, it's closer to zero to slightly positive. So there's been some slowdown, but it is up over recessionary lows, and the forecast calls for meager growth for at least the next couple of years.
Okay. And then a third different topic, if I may. You basically said that the change in corporate tax revenues was I forget the exact language you used, but you were pretty negative about that. In earlier projections, you or the person in your position have said that there was an expectation that as corporations started to invest further in the economy, that profits and therefore tax revenue would decline. I wonder if that is a factor in this or if it's entirely negative.
Yes, Representative Barnard, I think it's a primary factor. The chart I put up earlier showing the profits to the hiring, you know, that would be the mechanism. Your type of argument would be the mechanism behind that. I've switched here to the corporate income tax chart to give you an idea of what we're calling for in terms of a hangover. You see in the past the big mountains that this series goes through, the huge amount of volatility we see, and after the kind of climb that we've had, and it looks like we've turned the corner, we're going to expect some kind of pullback. As Representative Barnard mentioned, that's not all a bad thing. You know, to the extent that this reflects firms increasing their cost side by investing and hiring, and they're digging into profits that way, that's a good thing. It's not good for tax revenues in the near term, but it's certainly a good thing for the global economy and other tax revenues. It's not the corporate collections. But we have it coming off here, and the degree to which it comes off is highly uncertain. And so there is a lot of risk with the corporate forecast. Over the extended horizon, you see here, we do expect some growth in corporate income taxes. And what that has to do with is a lot of the tax environment or the policy environment. We switched in the middle of the 2000s. We switched to a single sales factor. That we haven't seen in the data yet because we had this tremendous recession. But eventually, we expect our average receipts to be higher, and of course, Measure 67 as well is going to be reflected in the future.
And then a final topic, if I may. You've mentioned both Measure 66 and 67, and of course, both of those measures had rates declining again for high-income people in Measure 66 and for corporations in 67. What would be the effect on your revenue forecast if those rates had not changed, if they'd remained the same through the rest of this biennium instead of declining at the end of 11?
Representative Barnard, Paul, would you like to... Would you like to make sure I don't mess this one up?
I think that's Representative Barnard. I know Chris has worked on that and has some estimates of what that is.
But it would definitely, the revenue estimate would definitely be higher now, would it not, if those rates had not changed?
for Measure 66, well, the estimate going forward would certainly be higher because, as you recall, 2012 tax year is when it drops to the single 9.9% from the 10.8 and 11 has collapsed to 9.9. There's also the corporate rate goes down in two different stages, beginning with the 12 year and then into the and then again in 13, where we make the adjustment up to the higher rate applying to 10 million and above. But we can get you those numbers. We have estimates of what it would be, what the forecast would be under those old rates compared to what this one is.
All right. And, thank you. And, Madam Chair, my point, of course, is that despite the fact that rates are going down, revenue is continuing to go up, and overall impact on the economy, maybe not our taxes necessarily in all cases, but the economy is positive. Thank you. I appreciate the chance to ask all these different questions on these different topics.
Thank you. You've covered the waterfront. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. To return, I think, to Representative Barnhart's first point, I just want to make sure that I understood the answer correctly. This $35 million change, if memory serves, is relatively small compared to previous forecasts that you've presented. Is it fair then to say that to sum it up, that the economy is growing, that we're adding jobs, and that it's happening more predictably, and that difference is getting smaller?
Yes, Representative Bailey, I think that is a good characterization. I think the outlook has certainly stabilized.
Thank you.
Senator Hess.
Thanks. I didn't see that. You might not have this data, and maybe I missed it, but Oregon has been, personal income has been 91% of the national average. Does anything here change that up or down, one or the other, or we don't have that?
Yes, Senator Haas, we expect Oregon's incomes, for a variety of reasons, are not going to converge to those of the U.S. and are going to be below, in the outlook, we have them below the U.S. going forward. That said, during this recovery period, we will make up some of the ground, and certainly the mix of jobs right now is pretty good. And again, our narrative of these professional business services and investment goods and whatnot, these are a lot of high-paying industries. So, the mix right now in terms of job growth is good. But where we are right now, I like to step back and I worry about the income issue is a big one. It's a big one for economic development and our long-run outlook. But right where we are right now, no job is a bad job. I just want any. I don't care, how much they make.
We'll follow up.
Is that an economist?
The national income is going down on average. When you say make up ground, are we going from 91 to 98 or holding it around 91, or is that data available?
I don't have those exact percentages in front of me, but in terms of, in our appendix of our forecast, we have per capita income, U.S. versus Oregon, line by line. And over the next 3 or 4 years, our growth rate is projected to be faster than that, just due to the stronger projected employment gains, which raises the overall income. But then again, as we get the stronger population growth, once the migration pattern rebounds in terms of the net flows, that's going to start weighing on our per capita income as we start growing faster than the U.S. again in terms of population. So you have these competings where our economy is more volatile, so we'll grow faster and incomes will grow quicker during the upswing, but then you also have a larger population base that weighs that down because you divide that as your denominator. So I don't know what percentage it is, whether it's 91, 92. Do we get up to 94? I'm not quite sure in 5 years' time, but I can do that math.
Okay.
Back in the office.
Thanks.
Madam Chair and Senator Haas, I just one very quick point I'd make there, because we pay a lot of attention to that per capita income number. You can explain statistically about 60% of the variation in incomes among states, per capita incomes, by knowing one thing: what fraction of the adult population has a four-year college degree? And that's the single biggest factor that influences that. So if you want to push up Oregon income, particularly over the long term, I mean, we'll fluctuate around that 91-92% given the macroeconomic factors my colleagues have talked about. But if you want to change bend the curve in the long run, you've got to increase the educational attainment of the population to do so. And so I'd part company just a little bit with Mark there, in that it really does matter how well you educate your people as to how good of jobs you get and what kind of incomes you have as a state.
Joe, you are speaking my language,
yep.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just to go off on this, around 91%. Washington is around 106% nationally. And there's lots of factors into that, but one that I can't take my eyes off is they have a much higher percentage of college graduates in Washington than we do. So that's why I think part of the way home is economic development, but a big way home is raising the number of college grads we have in the state, which is set out now in law with our 40-40-20, but also a lot of what we're doing with this rather dull slogging work on reforming our higher education system to get more people with degrees in their hand in the state.
Absolutely, Senator Haas. I agree. I think it's these broader investments, not just in educational attainment is a great one, the human capital, but also other capital investments can also raise the productivity of all workers and the wages. So infrastructure investments and the like. Are also, you know, viable options there. If you really want, you know, average incomes to raise across the entire metropolitan area or entire state, you need to look at these broader things like educational attainment and infrastructure and to what extent we can increase the productivity of our workers.
Thank you. Senator Topher.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment on that is that not only do we increase the education, which I'm all in support of, but we also have to increase the jobs that would pay those higher wages for those highly educated people. But the comment I wanted to make was, you know, I appreciate the conversation, the fact that our revenue to the general fund is up. But before we pull out the cakes and the balloons and celebrate, I've got to remind everybody that the cost of providing services to Oregonians through the state is going up more, and we are still cutting $201 million out of the budget. So, you know, while that's increasing, the cost of doing business is increasing at a higher rate.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. This was actually good news compared to what it could have been. So appreciate your answering your questions and presenting the forecast. So with that, we will recess for about 2 minutes while our House colleagues go their own ways here.
25, so but we're still splitting.
We will emerge from recess for the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. We will be carrying over Senate Bill 1519, 1532, and 1530 to Monday's agenda for lack of paperwork and other factors.
You don't want to come Friday?
I'm sorry, did I say Monday?
You said Monday.
Oh, excuse me. Correction. We will carry these over till Friday.
Just seems like Friday.
Just because there has been so much interest in Senate Bill 1532, the only holdup there is just a paperwork lag, and so we fully expect to be able to move that bill quickly out of this committee on Friday. So today we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 1531. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1531 is the Reconnect Bill, and you have, in a moment, you will have two amendments that are being handed out. There's a dash one and a dash five. The dash one simply adds language pertaining to the Oregon College Savings, Oregon 529 College Savings Program. There was a reference to the Internal Revenue Code. The amendment just adds that date, so it'll you'll see that in future Reconnect bills.
Okay, so there is no fiscal or revenue impact from that?
Correct.
Addition.
That
okay.
piece has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. That was brought to our attention by Treasury. Their lawyers would prefer to have a date on that IRC reference.
Okay.
So that fits the theme of the main body of the bill. The dash 5 pertains...
It's right in the same stack that you just got, right
Didn't go deep enough.
The dash 5 pertains to the testimony you heard last time pertaining to the domestic production activities deduction. And this one, if you recall from that testimony, by the way, the Assembly disconnected from the Section 199 deduction back in 2005, a recent interpretation by the Department of Revenue would alter the way the deduction is taken for patronage dividends. Basically, disconnecting from Section 199 affected the patronage dividend deduction. Uh-huh. And so the dash 5 would basically codify the way these co-ops have been filing their tax returns for the past 5 or 6 years.
And it was, you were around then, it was clearly our legislative intent at that time to have that be the case, correct?
I believe so. The intent in recent years has been when you disconnect from a federal provision, or at least the way I think about it or try to articulate it, is when you disconnect from federal provision X, the intent is to calculate Oregon taxes as though that federal provision did not exist. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what the co-ops have been doing by filing their tax returns, this disconnect from the well, let me back up. In federal law, the Section 199 deduction, there are two groups of co-ops, those that take this deduction and the co-op claims it, and those that pass the deduction on to their patrons. In the former group, when they don't pass the deduction on, there is no problem, there's no discrepancy, there's no, everything's fine there. It's when the co-ops have to pass on, the co-ops that pass on the deduction to their patrons, they have to claim that deduction on their federal return, and they have to reduce their patronage dividends by a corresponding amount on the federal return. So when it comes time to disconnect from Oregon, the statute very literally says, look at your federal return, take that amount of the deduction and add it back to Oregon, and you're not allowed to make an adjustment for patronage dividends. The way the co-ops have been filing their tax returns is they've been doing the add back, but they've been claiming the amount of patronage dividends they would be allowed to claim if the Section 199 deduction did not exist. I don't know if that's clear at all.
Clear as mud.
Clear as mud. There was no opposition expressed to this, correct?
I'm not aware of
I understand
of
what you said.
The short version is they have a double taxation if we do not adopt this.
Okay.
Yes.
So we will.
Because of the patronage, the effect on the the disconnect affected the patronage dividends. The intent probably was not to affect that. You do have the paperwork showing a no revenue impact, and there is a minimal expenditure impact on from the Department of Revenue.
Okay. All right. Any questions from the committee? Senator Morris, do we have a motion on the Dash 1 amendment?
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1531, dated 2312.
Senator Morris has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1531. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1531, dated 2612.
Senator Morris has moved the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 1531. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1531 as amended by the Dash 1s and the Dash 5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 1531 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, this is going to the floor, and I think there is only one person that we can turn to here to carry this.
Chris.
Senator Telfer, why? Yeah. Senator Telfer, why are you laughing? Senator Telfer will carry this. All right, committee, if there's no further business, we are adjourned. Business, we are adjourned.